Evening, everybody. Okay, today we are in Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Aleph. There is a Gemara in the end of Maseches Sanhedrin that says that David asked God to take this story out of the Tanakh. What do people have to read it for? The Gemara darshans this from the Pesukim at the end of Tehillim, chapter 19. David first asks Shkios Miavim, right? Ministeros Nakeni Gam Mizedim Chasoch Avdecha. Will you forgive me for my mistakes? Will you forgive me for the things I don't even know I did wrong? Will you forgive me for the things I did with intent? And then he says, Alim Shiluvi Uz Esam. Will you make sure that people don't get the best of me on this? Right, the various Gemaras, you have the people questioning what David did in this story. I have an issue with such statements. It's not clear that anyone in Israel besides Yoav knew what happened in this story. And of course, Bathsheba. Right? Not quite clear. I think that had Avshalom, had it been common knowledge that David did this with Bathsheba, Avshalom would have used it, Adoniyahu would have used it. Right? People who rebelled would have used this information. They would have said that Shlomo is not fit for Malchus because of his origins. So I think that David did a proper tshuva. He atoned. He suffered for the rest of his life because of this indiscretion, and Hashem accepted his tshuva. But it's not quite mashma that. That this was common knowledge, what David had done with Bathsheba, as some Gemaras indicate. Okay, let's go into the text and see that when David did get his way in two ways. One, Hashem said, I will not let them get the best of you because I will assure that the story is written, in wherever it's written and canonized, that it is written to be, to possibly derive in a certain way to, if not, I'm not absolve you altogether, of course, but that you have, there are ways to judge you b'kafschos, let's put it that way. And I will mention those and some of the commentaries that disagree. Okay. And the question of removing it from Tanakh, so it's not in Divrei Hayamim. Okay, there is a chapter that begins by Hilu Tshuvas Hashanah Leistzei Samalachim, and it just continues that David fought the war and then against the Ammonites, but it doesn't say anything about David seeing the wife of one of those soldiers, it just skips over it. So David did get his way in Divrei Hayamim, but in Sefer Shmuel, the story is indeed told. Okay, so let's quickly read through it. And remember that the Israelites are fighting a war with Ammon that was precipitated from what we learned last week because of that unfortunate story of how the Ammonite king sent back David's emissaries. It's very curious if the king was indeed concerned, as his advisors suggested, that David is not interested in spreading goodwill to you at the loss of your father, but he just wants to spy your palace so he can tell it where, how to conquer it. So why would you let those spies run home? And why would you get them take the information they derived and take it home? Punishment for spies is always death. So it's a bit of a pella that they let them go home if the king was indeed truly concerned with that. But the answer is he wasn't. The king of Ammon just wanted to find an alilah in order to go to battle with Israel and have Israel be seen as the aggressor. Okay, so it's at this war, Bayit Tshuvat HaShanah Le'is Tzei Samlochim. And when is this time of year? So strategists from this time, this time in history, we see some extra biblical writings at this time, is you don't want to fight anything in the rainy season. Your chariots will be neutralized in the mud. And you also don't want to fight in the dead of summer. Your soldiers will become parched very quickly from the intense heat. There's not enough water for them. So it has to be close enough to the rainy season where some of the streams can still supply water. Can't fight for more than a few days without water, right? And but you don't want it to be too far away from the rainy season where the water will dry up. You don't want it to be too close to the rainy season where the roads are still muddy. So there's just a short window for this, okay? It's sort of the early to late spring. Okay, the story takes place in April or May, and possibly even June. Okay, Vayishlach David this Yoav v'Savadav Imal, as Kol Yisrael. So David sent Yoav and his servants and all of Israel to fight against the Ammonites. Vayishchisu es b'nei Ammon, v'yitzur al Rabba v'David Yoshev b'Yerushalayim. Already we see something unusual because David usually went out to battle with his people. Right here, he stays home in Yerushalayim. Okay, remember, we've had the Lashon, who's Motzi Umevi et Ha'am. Right? When Moshe begged God in Parshas Pinchas after he was told he would die, he said, God, please don't leave them without a leader, Hamotzi, right? Umevi es Osam. Moshe uses the same exact Lashon. Okay, so that's usually what David did. That's usually how he prosecuted battles. But in this case, he's at home in Yerushalayim. So small little infractions and little changes in habit, we see the irony of what results. David should have been at battle with his soldiers. And Vayila Esa Erev, Vayokam David Me'al Mishkavo. This is snowballing. Who takes naps in the middle of the day while his nation is fighting a battle? I don't know. I think Winston Churchill did, but It's the fact that he's sleeping in the afternoon. I have to tell you, if you run through your Pekiyas of the Bible, any king who takes naps in the afternoon, it's nishkit, right? Ishbosheth is assassinated while taking a nap in the afternoon, right? Eglon Melech Moav is assassinated while resting in his cool room in the afternoon. Right, but we should. I understand important people need some rest, and they need sometimes a little siesta in the middle of the day. But things just don't go well when kings do that. Certainly not when there's like an emergency situation. People are in battle. Okay, so he wakes up in the afternoon, towards the evening. Vayishalech al gag. Now, vayishalech is different than vayelech. Vayishalech means not just a stroll, but he's walking back and forth. Right? So, vayishalech, you know, it's the, it's sort of like a reflexive thing. It's a back and forth. So, and he's taking a walk on his patio, which is certainly acceptable. A king can do that. Right? So, the reason why I'm stressing this is because the David is about to do something wrong on his roof. But the wrong thing was not that he was taking a walk on his roof. The wrong thing is that he saw something that he should have quickly turned away from. Mm-hmm. Right? I say this also because later on in the story, David constantly gets like mida keneged mida, you know, measure for measure for what he did. And in this particular case, it is something that's exactly predicted by the prophet. The prophet in punishment in chapter 12, because at this point, even at the very beginning of the story, it's crucial to read a little bit of chapter 12, or I'll just reveal some of it to you, in order to spice up our story appropriately in the very beginning. And here it is. the prophet tells David, you did this secretly. You tried to cover it up. You want to make sure no one knows about it. And you've pretty much succeeded, except that there's a prophet in Israel who knows what you did. You know, Yoav doesn't rebuke the king because Yoav is not in a position to rebuke the king. In other words, Yoav said, what? You want me to put one of our chief generals in the front lines on a suicide mission? Who does such a thing? And then Yoav finds out that a week later he marries the widow? Oh, come on. Yoav can figure things out. Right? So, one of the things the prophet tells David is, you did this secretly, but I'm going to have this done to you way out in the open. And that is fulfilled when Avshalom, David's own son, violates 10 of David's concubines. And where does it say that happened? Anybody? What do you think?
And the hearing is, thank you.
Right. On the roof, correct, Dr. O'Hayon. On this very roof. Right? Why does the Tanakh care to tell me that? So it's starting off to tell us that David did something wrong right here. In other words, well, the wrong thing, obviously, is what happened, is that he called her in, right? And she came. But here's the thing I would like to go further with chapter 12, is a Gemara in Maseches Sukkah, in Daf Nun Beis, says that in the parable that the prophet tells David, in that parable, we see that there's a rich man who has many, many sheep, and a poor man who has one sheep, and we'll see this next week. There's a little too much information about how much this poor man loves this sheep. It just gets a little too far. I can imagine David's kidding, prophet, get on with the story. What's going on here? What happened? So he says that the rich man had a halech, a passerby that came to his house. And he didn't want to take any of his own many, many sheep to give to the guest. Now this passerby all of a sudden becomes a guest. To his guest, to the oreach. First he's called a halech, then he's called an oreach. And then he's called and he says he took the one sole lone sheep that the poor man loved so much. He took that one sheep away from the poor man to give to the ish haba'elav. It's all in one pasuk, per yud beis pasuk dalet. First the man is called the oreach, then he's called the halech, then the oreach, then the ish. Right? Okay, this I'm sure everybody here knows because you're good in biblical narrative, is that the rich man is David, the poor man is Uriah, the sheep is Bathsheba. Who's the guest?
Who's the guest?
The rich man with many sheep, that's David. The poor man with just one sheep, that's Uriah.
The Yetzirah.
Right, the Yetzirah. Right? The Yetzirah starts off as a halech. David's walking on his roof, and he sees something he probably shouldn't have seen. Right? The Gemara wonders, how did he get to see that? I mean, what was she doing? So Grade in the movie, I don't know if you want to ever saw the movie with Gregory Peck. In the movie, at some point, she tells him that she purposely exposed herself, which is ridiculous. But in the movie, I'm pointing this out for a particular moral message, which Hollywood doesn't care about. In the movie, she has an abusive marriage. Uriah is abusive in the movie. Why did they do that? Again, if she's in an abusive marriage, and doesn't pay any attention to me, and he's in battle all the time, he doesn't care to come home, right? I mean, the reader is conflicted because in the parable, the man loves his sheep, right? He loves his sheep. He adores his sheep. The sheep sleeps at his side. The sheep eats at his table. In the parable, the man adores his sheep. But in the storyline, he doesn't go home. He has a furlough from battle. He doesn't go home. How do you not go home? Right? So, okay. But here's the point. In Hollywood, where they still cared enough to blunt the effect of what happened, oh, well, at least it was a bad marriage. No! Adultery is adultery. I don't care what the marriage was. You hear what I'm saying? Is that it doesn't matter what kind of marriage Bathsheba and Uriah had. Right? But, like the Gemara says, David asked God for the story to be told in a way which can possibly absolve him even differently. And let's move in that direction now. Okay? The reason why I took this tangent is because according to the storyline, there's something wrong with what David does already at the Gog. Okay? So, Vayari Yisharo Chetzes Me'al HaGog, he saw someone bathing. Vayisha Tovas Mare Ma'od. That Ma'od means, Okay. According to the Gemara that I mentioned before, she was bathing on her rooftop behind a screen that fell. Okay. All right. The king's Gog should not really be in view of anything that's so compromising. It wasn't. It was just a situation that just happened to happen. And when David caught hold of it, he wasn't looking for it. Not like he went up there with binoculars or anything. He just saw it, and he was there, and he should have turned away while the halach could still get punched out. Right? It's a lot easier to toss a halach out than to toss out an oreach or an ish. You get it? Right?
Yeah.
Halavai, we should learn from this Gemara. In fact, the Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah, Daf Dalet, says that David was told, the reason why this story is in Tanakh is so that people can learn from your mistakes of how to fight their own Yetzirah. Right? I think it may just be true that no matter how many times you've pressed the snooze button, it doesn't make it any easier to finally get out of bed. Right? You still have to drag yourself out of bed. You're still going to have to. And then, look, it may be that after every shot of whiskey, it makes it harder and harder not to have more. Right? Anyway, but here is the issue. Right? If most people would see such a thing, even if the Yetzer Hara was attracted, you know, if the Yetzer Hara in the hands of a king, it could be a very dangerous thing, because a king is usually used to getting what he wants, right? Anybody else would call Bathsheba and she would, you know, please come over to my house. I have something to give you, or something like that. She's not going to go. The king calls you, you got to go. Right? Okay, so, Vayishlach David, Vayidrosh La'isha. So the first thing David does is he inquires about the woman. Rashi writes, is she married or not? Vayomer. And here's the answer they give. Halo zos bat sheva baseli ameshes uri hachiti. What's this halo doing there? He was saying, halo zos bat sheva baseli, right? It really has the same effect. She's known. Her husband is well known. Her father is well known. Her grandfather is well known. Okay? Divrei Hayamim. Right, Eliam is the son of Achitophel. Okay, Achitophel was responsible for the rebellion of Avshalom. We'll have to say, if he was Bathsheba's grandfather, you know, why was he intent on Avshalom being king? Surely he would want the child of his own granddaughter to be king. He must have been pretty old, also. Okay, so, but she is the wife of Uriah Hachiti. And if you look at the very end of Shmuel Bet, I shouldn't say the very, very end, but in Perek Chof Gimel, where it lists David's chief soldiers and generals, right? You see the last pasuk in Perek Chof Gimel? Pasuk Lamed Tes. It says, Uriah Hachiti, Kol Shloshim Veshiva. It lists David's top generals, and Uriah Hachiti is among them. And Shmuel Bet, he's listed last. And Divrei Hayamim, he's listed much earlier. If anybody listening is enticed to answer that since Bathsheba was married to a Hittite, she wasn't really halachically married, Chazal draws such a suggestion at the end of Maseches Kiddushin, but they reject it. They reject it just as they know that that's the tradition. Uriah was a Jewish man. It's a very Semitic name. Hittites would not name a person Uriah. And he's called Hachiti for the same reason that Oved Edom Hagiti is called that, even though he wasn't a Philistine. All right? Gath is one of the five Philistine cities. So how do I know he wasn't a Philistine? The answer is because Oved Edom Hagiti, a very famous Jew in Divrei Hayamim, was the man in whose house the Aron stayed.
Oh, right.
After Uzzah pushed it up and he couldn't take it to Yerushalayim. And in Divrei Hayamim, it says explicitly he was a Levi. He was in charge of Levitical activities with respect to the Aron. So how do you call an Oved Edom Hagiti? Look, I don't know what his parents were thinking, but that's his name, right? Okay, there are people in Sefer Shmuel who have like a foreign name at the end of their name, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that they were genealogically of that race or of that people. It means that they came from that locality, that general place. They were parents who passed
same,
by.
That's, Rabbi, that's the same as a lot of Sephardi who are called Ashkenazi but have the last name.
Okay, yeah, that could be. Okay, so when we say Uriachiti, no one should at least the Radak draws the suggestion and then quotes Chazal that say that Uriah was a Jewish man. It's a Semitic name. It's not Chiti are Canaanites. So I don't believe that that's a worthwhile answer to resolve David's problem. Okay, all right. So they said, isn't that Bathsheba bat Eliam Meshes Uriah Chiti? In other words, they're trying to say, David, whatever you're thinking, this is not a good idea. Okay, but the next pasuk also begins with the word Vayishlach. He didn't take no for an answer here. Right, because by now, Chevra, the Yetzer Hara, is in full Ish mode. Right? It's well past the Halech and Oreach stage. But here is a curious thing. It says, Vayishlach David Malochim. He sent messengers. I would have sent one. What do you have to send to? Just to give a kavod? I'm sending you an entourage? Two men can wink at each other as they're going from the king's palace and say, ooh, what do you think the king wants from her? Right? Send one discreet messenger. Two messengers means that it's more people are going to talk about it. I don't know. What do you think? Right? I wouldn't send more than one at a time. Unless what this can mean is that David kept sending one messenger numerous times. Maybe not even the same one. Probably not the same one because it says Malachim. He sent one to get her. Okay? I didn't quite get the Vayishkav and Vayida. And it says, Let's read it. It says, "Vayishlach David malachim vayikocheha." David sent messengers and he took her in. Vayikocheha, vayikach is the lashon of marriage. Of course, that's not what's happening here. It says, "Vatavo a love," which is an unusual formulation. It's true she had to come to the palace, no doubt, but the terminology for this is usually vayavo a leha, right? Vatavoe love. These are two important words because the main Gemara in all of Shas that analyzes what David did here is a Gemara in Ksuvas Daf Tes. And the purpose of that Gemara is to analyze the concept of what a woman does in an extramarital affair that renders her prohibited to her husband under all circumstances. But here's the rub. On Daf Tes in Maseches Ksuvos that says that whenever a woman is rendered prohibited to her husband as a result of this act, she is forever rendered prohibited to the very man she's with also, halachically. Which, of course, makes the Gemara ask the obvious question, Chevra, for the rest of Shmuel Bet, not to mention the glory of building the Beis HaMikdash, namely,
why is she not prohibited to David?
How could David remain married to Bathsheba? How does that union, David and Bathsheba, produce the next king?
Yes.
God seems to be okay with. It says that God loved him. God named him Yedidya, Vashema Hevo. How is this possible? In the formulation of the Gemara, it's really quite an impossibility. If she was rendered prohibited to her husband, she should be rendered prohibited to David as well, forever, according to the Gemara. So the Gemara says if David did tshuva, how do we acknowledge the fact that he stayed with her? So the Gemara gives two answers to this question. Right.
Tshuva?
The Gemara gives two answers to this question. Most of you probably know the second answer, which the Rebbetzin just gave, said over now discreetly. Most of you know the second answer. That kol hayotze lemelchemes beis David get priestess hayonosein leishto. Is that Bathsheba's husband was away at war. And when the men went to war, and there's good Tanakh proof for what I'm about to tell you, plus the fact that husbands do this to this day when they go to war. Right? Is they give, if they, unless they're a Kohen.
Given out to my get.
Right, t'nai, a get al t'nai. They give their wife a conditional get. We'll see a machlokas Rashi tells us about this, what Jenny just mentioned. They give their wives a get al t'nai, and the t'nai reads as follows. If I don't return from the battle when the battle is considered ended by an act of the Knesset or the king or whatever else, in other words, this date that's going to say this war is over. If I don't return within a year or 2 years, however long they want to say, month, a week, if I don't return within X amount of time after the cessation of hostilities, you are divorced from this day, from this moment. That's how it works. If I don't return, you are divorced from now. This was not only to prevent from aguna, that's obvious. Aguna meaning that if the husband is missing in action or he's taking something else like that, right? That she's going to be like a helpless widow for years and years and years, right? It's not only that, okay? But I just ask you a question. If he goes to battle on January 1st and he says, if I don't return from battle within 1 month of the end of hostilities, you're divorced from today, January 1st, right? And he dies on March 1st. Is she a widow or is she a divorcee? What think you?
Oh.
She's divorced.
She's divorced.
Yes, yes, because he did not return from the battle. And so it wasn't only about Aguna. The Gemara was concerned also with Yibum and Chalitza. That she shouldn't be given to Yibum or Chalitza as a widow if she didn't have if he didn't leave any children. Okay? It's an additional concern from the Gemara. After all this tragedy, she can't move on because the brother won't give her a Chalitza. Okay? All right, so be it as it may, the proof of this, the Gemara says, is that in a battle with the battle with Goliath, where the Philistines were fighting with the Jews, it says that messengers went to the husbands to deliver tokens to their wives. Now, those tokens, objects, the Gemara explains, was the gittin, these conditional divorces. Okay, all right. So if that's the case, then since Uriah did not ever return from battle, so Bathsheba was retroactively a free woman. Wait a second, not so fast. Let's read a little more of the story, and then we'll analyze this. Okay. Vayishkav ima v'hi miskadeshes mitumasa v'tashav el besa. He slept with her. Apparently, right there, right, sent for her. It was that same time. But be sure that she was miskadeshes mitumasa. The question of whether she's married is not the only problem here, right? She may be in a state of nida. You can't just, even the king can't just take a woman off the street and say, okay, I want you now, right? In fact, Chazal say that that's what she was doing on her roof. At that time, the best mikveh you could have is rainwater on your roof in a collected vessel. Right, it's the simplest, obviously easiest mikvah. Just get a receptacle on your roof and collect the rainwater. But you better have it screened, right? Because mikvahs are, we're not in a good state of tznius when you go to the mikvah, right? All right. So that's what the pasuk means when it says she was not in a state of ritual impurity. But wait a second.
But that should have been before.
What was the question?
Why does it say after Vaishkavima?
In case the reader, it's sort of like putting in parentheses. Oh, by the way, reader, if you're curious, how does a man get to just take a woman at any moment? I mean, the question is, did he take her against her will? Right? It says Vatavoi love. All right, well, that's the Gemara's first answer. When the Gemara says, how could David stay married to Bathsheba? It gives two answers. One, because she was actually technically divorced at the time, even though her husband was still alive. Right? The first answer the Gemara gives is, get this, I don't like to give this answer because it makes David look even worse than the Pasuk. The Gemara says, Ones Shari. Ones Shari, which means that if David took her against her will, she was never rendered prohibited to her husband. That's obvious, right? A woman taken against her will, there's a different rule between a Kohen and her, but Uriah Kachiti is not a Kohen, right? And if she was taken against her will, then since she wasn't rendered prohibited to her husband, get this, she also wasn't rendered prohibited to David. It's a package deal. Right? That's the Gemara's first answer that no one ever quotes. Gemara's second answer is the famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbos that says that these men divorced their wives. Okay? Now it's her turn to send messengers. She conceived. And she sent for David to tell him, Hara Anochi. This should be a good story for the pro-life movement. There were potions to drink at that time, which would abort a baby. That's never an option in our story.
Rabbi, how much time do you think elapsed from Vayishkav until Vatahar? Well, when she notified King David, would it be a month later, 2 months later? And does that play an important role with what we're going to see with Ori in a moment?
I think it can't be too long. I'll tell you why. Because at the end of the story, when Uriah dies, it says David collects her. He brings her in, and he marries her quickly, right after the Avel is over. It's the very end of chapter 11. And he has to do that. You know, a woman whose husband dies is not allowed to remarry within 3 months, according to the halacha. Right? Okay, we're not putting everything through the rigors of halacha here, but for obvious reasons, in which case she's pregnant, she wants to make sure who's the father of the child, my first husband or my second husband, right? But obviously David has to marry her as quickly as possible because she's giving birth in about 7.5-8 months. But if this was 3 months later, then there's really no time at all for this.
Right.
She's not going to give birth in 5 months to a big bouncing baby. Right? So I think it's quick. It's quick, matter of two weeks or so. Whether or not Maseches Nida allows a woman to halachically be considered pregnant that soon is questionable for various other issues right there in the beginning of the Masechta even, but for here it's pretty swift in terms of the pasuk. But Tishlach v'tagid David v'tomer hara anochi. What happened in between? Right, I think it's quick. I think this is just weeks later. Not months later, right? But abortion is never an option, and David has first a cover up. Vayishlach David el Yoav, shlach Eli es Uriah hachiti. Look at all the vayishlachs here. It's almost like a milat mancha. Vayishlach Yoav es Uriah el David. Milat mancha means a word that is constantly appearing again and again and again. Vayishlach means to send. We're going to see Vayishkav quite often also. Means that Vayishlach is that people are sort of sending off their obligation. You know, it's what a cover-up does. Something simple becomes more elaborate. And a small sin snowballs into a big sin, which is what we our segue from last week. And David has to send for Uriah to spend the time on a furlough at home, as Rashi says, very simply, so that when Bathsheba does give birth some months from now, Uriah will remember that he was home with his wife before that. And David has to just hope that the child isn't born with red hair and freckles. Okay, so David is a redhead. So that's his plan. Now, what do you think also? If Uriah had gone home, would David have just cleaned his hands from the whole thing and maybe, you know, give the kid a scholarship fund or something for college of his choice, maybe look after him a little? Would David wash his hands of the whole thing? We'll never know, of course. What's the point of the cover-up? Cover-up is David realized he did something wrong. And he wants to cover it up. And if he can successfully cover it up, who knows what will be. Does he totally wash his hands of the whole thing and just forget about Bathsheba? We'll never know, of course, but Vayavoa Uriah Elav. Now, Uriah appears before his king. Vayishal David l'shlom Yoav l'shlom ha'am l'shlom ha'milchama. How's Yoav doing in this order? How are the people doing? By the way, how's the war doing? Uriah does not think this is unusual because of what I exposed you to before at the end of chapter 23. He's a chief general. Right? If he's just a lowly private, he must be wondering, why is the king calling me home? What does he need from me? No, but Uriah is a strategist. He knows, you know, right? So don't think this is unusual. Okay? Vayomer David l'Uriah. Now look at the next word, the verb raid. Lebeischa, right? Raid Lebeischa. Now, it's true that that is a geographical delineation. David's palace was on the hill, and Bathsheba's and Uriah's residence was down the hill. Okay? So he says, go down to your house. He should have said, bo Lebeischa. Instead, he says, go down to your house, rechatz raglechen, wash your feet. Right? I think that this is a euphemism. Okay? Right? Sometimes washing the feet is just washing the feet. Right? Like when Avraham invites three men who are standing in the distance in the heat of the sun, washing the feet is something, the first thing you do after such a time, your feet are blistered. But when you're talking about a man appearing before his king, doesn't say what time of day it was, but and he says, go home and wash your feet. Yeah, that's a euphemism. Abigail, back in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Chafei, said to David, oh, but I could be your handmaiden to wash your feet. She's proposing to him. Right? Okay. So, this is what it means here. Vayetzei Uriah mibeis hamelech, vatetzei acharav masas hamelech. And Uriah refuses to go home. Now, why does he refuse to go home? He tells his king later. He's a man of honor. My men are in battle. The Aron is in battle. Okay. Do you remember when David went to the high priest and asked for food? Remember that?
No.
Remember what the Kohen Gadol told him?
In Nov,
yes. The Kohen Gadol said to him, this is holy bread. It's the only bread I have. In the very least, have your men been separated from women? Right? He said, in the very least, have the soldiers been atzur me'isha? Why? Because this bread is holy. And if the Aron is in battle, Uriah says, how can I be intimate with my wife when we're in battle and we have the Aron there? The Machana has to be Kadosh. Whatever the reason is that Uriah refuses to go home to his wife, it's honorable. Some of Farshim even say that when he slept in the street, some people were aware of what had happened, and they told him, do you know where your wife went yesterday? And he sort of put two and two together. I'm not a fan of that kind of perush, because I do believe, I want to stay firm in the belief that it was not common knowledge in Israel what David had done. The Gemara says that God agreed to David he would keep the masses from knowing it, except when the story is canonized in the Bible. So I don't think that Uriah refused to go home because he was so angry with his wife for going to see the king. Uriah didn't know about that. I don't think so. I think he refuses to go home because of his honor. My men are in battle. I should have the comfort of my wife's company. Chas v'shalom. Vayishkav Uriah Pesach Beis HaMelech. A contrast between the Vayishkav of David and the Vayishkav of Uriah. And he slept iskol avdei Adonav, v'lo yarad el beiso. He slept amongst David's servants, but he did not go down, lo yarad. I think the yarad here is more than just a geographical denotation of the fact that he was up the hill and he would have to go down yirida. I think it connotes a mamash yirida. This is Beferish Gemara in Maseches Sota that notices that when Shimshon goes to Timnah, it says Vayered Shimshon Timnaso, and when Uriah goes to Yehuda goes to Timnah, it says Vayaal Yehuda Timnaso. The Gemara suggests there may be two cities called Timnah, one whose approach goes up, one whose approach goes down, or that it may have been the same exact city, it's just from two different ends, one where you have to go up, one where you have to go down. Or finally, the one that wants to fit here, is that the word Vayirid of Yorad means that what Yehuda ended up doing in Timnah ended up being an aliyah because he admitted his guilt. But what Shimshon did in Timnah was altogether bad, altogether negative. What he did there with the Zonah and everything he did there was wrong. So that's the point of Yerida, that it's not just a form of a geographical denotation. I think it really reaches its crescendo in the beginning of Yonah. Look in Yonah in his escape from God. The word Vayered appears about four times. And even when he goes into the depths of the ship and he falls asleep, the Tanakh uses a word that's also like Vayered, Vayeradam, right? Okay, and then he goes even further into the abyss as he's thrown into the water. And then he goes further into the abyss, into the whale. But as it's an important Yom Kippur message, since we read it on Yom Kippur afternoon, no matter how far you sink into the abyss, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can always, he always has his hand outstretched, ready to help you get out. So that's the term, the usage of the word Yorad. But I'm going to bring home here, look what David says to them. Yigidu leDavid leMor, Lo Yorad, again, Lo Yorad Uriah El Beiso, Vayem David El Uriah, Halomi Derech HaTaba, Madu Lo Yorad to El Beisecha. Come on, you came from a long way. Why didn't you go down to your house? Now here's the kicker. Look at the verb that Uriah is going to use. Look, Vayomer Uriah el David, Ha'aron v'Yisrael v'Yehuda yoshvim basukos. The Aron, Israel, and all of Yehuda, they're all sitting outdoors in tents, prosecuting this battle. And remember what I said before about the Aron and the Kohen Gadol. How can I be with my wife? I would pollute the Aron. And he says, Vadoni Yoav, Avdei Adoni al Pnei HaSadeh Chonim. Right? According to the Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin, by referring to Yoav as my master in front of the king, that was his rebellion, for which the king had the right to kill him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's a little spurious. But Vavdei Adoni al Pnei HaSadeh Chonim. And your servants are all scattered around the field. Va'ani, look at the next word. Va'ani avo el beisi le'echov lishtos. He should have said va'ani ered el beisi, but just by using the same verb the whole text has been using all this time. Va'ani avo el beisi, because for David was a yerida, for him it's a bia. The common terminology used in Tanakh for that. Vani avo el beisi, right? Lechob lishtos v'lishkav, I should have comfort. V'lishkav imishti chayecha v'chei nafshecha imeses edivar hazeh. Wow. He's really defeating the king. You know, the king has all these sheep and he has to take the one sheep. And this man, he loves his sheep so dearly, and yet he has the moral fortitude to stand down. By the way, if the parable were to be complete, wouldn't the rich man have to kill the poor man afterwards, right? No, that would go too far. That's too far. Then David would have gotten it, right? That's too far.
Isn't there a stark contrast between the words from Uriah? You see his emotion and his plea back to King David. Yet we don't see much emotion about King David and this whole act of just, you know, recalling him twice. You don't see him with any form of guilt or emotion. I know that Sifra Tehillim has that more, but can you comment on the differences in just their emotional pleas one to the other?
Yeah, so what Dr. Aaron is referring to is Tehillim chapter 51, which I do intend to learn after we do chapter 12. I think that anybody who teaches Davin Bat Sheva should always learn. It's the only parak in Tehillim that begins this way, but it talks the introduction, the heading is that David said this chapter when Nasan Anavi came to him, Kasher Ba'al Bat Sheva. So David, I think, is all business here. You know, I have an objective, right? Uriah can get emotional. No, Uriah isn't.
What happened?
Well, Uriah is in a fit of battle, right?
Sorry. Okay.
So he can be emotional, but David just has one, you know. It's sort of the way, look at the way that David and Bathsheba talk in last week's Haftorah. Did you notice the snippet? It's so snippety. It's so quick. It's so, it's just business. Three words here, four words there. Say, speak up. What do you have to say? Right? So I think that's David's MO, and you know, it's the way he talks to Tziva, it's the way he talks to Mephibosheth, and by this time it's sort of, remember the different stages David goes through in life, and I've coined it as like the Shaulization of David.
It's that
David was always protected from the violence. I've discussed this, I think, 2 weeks ago. David was always protected from the violence when we did chapter 8 and 9. Remember? The way that Pinchas was protected from what he did at the end of Parshas Balak with the Brisi Shalom. Right? He was protected with a blessing of peace. Shaul was not protected that way because the way he killed Amalek. He used sadism and personal gain in the performance of this very difficult mitzvah. So anyone with half a conscience is going to be disturbed. That's what brought him his melancholic behavior afterwards. That turned him schizophrenic. So because he was not given the Brisi Shalom that Pinchas was given. Right? But we did this at length, if you recall, a few weeks ago. So now that David basically joins Shaul in that group. Because of, and we even said that that's what validated him from building the temple back in chapter 7. Right? Mafreya, retroactively.
It's interesting that Uriah looks very noble here, and David, not at all.
Look, it gets better for Uriah because David gets him drunk.
Oh, yeah.
Right? He says, David tells him, you know, you really should stay another day. I'll send you tomorrow. When you're drunk, your inhibitions are weak. Right? David was hoping that in a state of drunkenness, he'll say, I could go back to my wife. Yeah, okay, I'll have some comfort. Right? So, but even in a state of drunkenness, right? It's that even in a state of drunkenness, his nobility is apparent, right?
Mm-hmm.
He is even in a weakened inhibition, able to put aside that one lone sheep that he loves so much, which, sorry to say, isn't even his anymore. Right? Here is my objection to the, who was the one of you mentioned? The conditional divorce. I think, Jenny, you mentioned get al tanai, right? So that's what Rashi says. Rabbeinu Tam in Bav Metzia Daf Nun Ches objects. He says that if this was a get al-tnai, then sending Uriah home as a cover-up, which is what Rashi says in the Gemara, as well as in his parish to this psukim, sending him to be home to sleep with his wife as a cover-up, so that when she gives birth 8 months from now, he won't wonder, how did you give birth? I've been away at war for 2 years. So that sending him home is the worst thing that David should want to do. Because then what happens? There's a new date on that get, right? You know what I'm saying? If a man says, you're divorced from this day, if I don't return from battle a month after this hostilities are over. If he does return when hostilities are over, he doesn't have to remarry his wife. He just has to return to his regular marital behavior, right? They don't have to reconsummate anything. You following? Everyone with me? Okay. So if he does return, and certainly if he's intimate with his wife, if he does go back home, don't you see? Finish my sentence. David's actions are retroactively adulterous. Unless you give the other answer, that he took her against her will, which I don't like. Right? No, there was the other answer for how could David stay married to her. But do you all agree, as Rabbeinu Tam says, that sending him home is really the last thing you want to do according to the way the Gemara presents it. So Rabbeinu Tam suggests that it wasn't a conditional divorce, it was a full divorce. And only the king knew which men gave their wives full divorces. In other words, Bathsheba wasn't even a married woman at all. She's called Eisha Suriachiti throughout the story because, you know, she was hoping to remarry him, you know, to get back together with him. I have a problem with Rabbeinu Tam also, I must say, and I have to close with this because I have to get started with the next year soon. But I have a problem with this too, because if Bathsheba was truly a free woman, right, her husband knew I gave her a get, right, David knew that she was a free woman, why have Uriah killed? Why send him to the front? Just tell him, Uriah, listen, I have good news and bad news. Right, first the bad news. That wife you were hoping to remarry after you came back from battle, sorry, she's taken. I know you're a toy soldier, what can we do? But that's what it is, okay? But here's the good news, all right? I have arranged for you to have 5 free houses in 5 different places in Israel. You don't have to pay taxes for the rest of your life. You're a made man, you have everything. I don't know, make his life, Just leave me alone with this free woman that you were hoping to remarry, but she's not free, I'm sorry to say. Why do you have to send him to die? Right? And Uriah wouldn't be in the Tanakh then. Right? Uriah gets in the Tanakh as a noble man. But let's try to think of some kind of answer for Rabbeinu Tam, because Rabbeinu Tam says that she was a totally free woman. So then why continue with the plan?
Rabbi, why would we need the words Vayikachecha v'tavoi elav? Why it should have just gone to Vayishkav imah? Wouldn't Vayikachecha mean that perhaps David got married to her that moment?
I suggested that when we did it, that Vayikachecha means that he actually married her.
That fits with Rabbi Tam's divorce thesis, no?
Oh, it certainly goes very well with it. In fact, I do believe he even suggests that this was, Bathsheba, I know that your husband is away in battle and he divorced you, right, more than 3 months ago. So now I'm marrying you. But there's some things in the story that doesn't stem with. For instance, she mourns for him at the end, right? All right, but I understand that. Her emotions were still hoping, you know, I have to hope that every married person, you know, would still hope that his wife or her husband would rather stay with him or her rather than the greatest movie star. No, I hope. the greatest, you know, the richest king, the richest. I should hope so, right? All right, but so David was sort of injecting himself because it's, you know, I'm the king and I can do what I want, but not in Israel because there is a prophet who knows. Okay, so there are going to be two people who know. One is Yoav, and one is Natan. We're going to continue next week, and I think we'll just be able to finish Perikid Aleph next week. And we're going to see what Yoav and Natan have to say about that, and why Yoav wielded so much power in the rest of Shmuel Bet. He wields quite a bit of power already, but that is where we are. Okay, thank you so much, everyone. Everyone had great comments tonight and great insights. And Mirza Shem, we will finish this chapter. And just always remember that when the Jew can't find the right words to say when someone is sick or when we're happy or when we're sad, we always turn to David HaMelech. So let's be careful and with trepidation, not to be too quick to explain these narratives, just the way we whatever meets the eye. There's a lot that's usually revealed underneath the biblical text, and great people sometimes mess up, as they say. And the greatness of these great people is that they admit their guilt and then they try to make good on it, and perhaps even spend the rest of their lives bearing penance. But that seems to be what David does. Okay, we'll continue Mitzvah Shem next week. Have a great week, everybody.